Hello, I'm Simon Burton and welcome to Arts Roundup, a programme that takes a close look into everything the arts community are doing in the Cambridge 105 FM region, finds out what makes creative people tick, captures their thoughts and ideas and explores their latest work and projects. In this edition, we visit Cardozo Kindersley's stone letter cutting workshop and look at the unique brand of stone calligraphy, bespoke sculptures, memorial stones and plaques, handcrafted with a humble hammer and chisel, which has carved a prestigious niche and openly defies the computer age. A programme for promoting experimental theatre sucks in comedy theatre group Wet Picnic and others and tests the wits and responses of the Cambridge audience at the city's Junction venue. Cambridge artist Kathy Parker invites people to put on their coats and woolly hats and drop into the Winter Open studios, meet the artists and view their latest work. And Cambridge University's Kettle's Yard Gallery welcomes a new director as Michael Harrison retires after 19 years in the post and passes the helm to Andrew Nairn. "Nothing is ever set in stone," a cousin recently said to me. Well, I discovered that that's not entirely true in Cambridge after an eye-opening visit to Cambridge stone letter-cutting studio Cardozo Kindersley, which simply has to be investigated for its talented people, artworks and unique designs, which are world-famous. Anyone who sees one of the hand-carved plaques, gravestones or sculptures will find them quite distinct, and there are many of them across Cambridge, the country, and possibly the most famous example is the iconic gates of the British Library. The studio in Victoria Road dates back to 1935 and was founded by the late David Kindersley, a former apprentice of the stone sculptor and artist Eric Gill, and after his death in 1995, his wife Leda Lopez Cardozo Kindersley carried on the stone carving tradition with her partner Graham Beck. Creating art in stone is no simple matter. It takes up to 7 years to train to standard and work flawlessly with a hammer and chisel. Leda trained as a graphic designer with the Royal Academy and later became a letter cutter, publisher, author and designer, and after meeting her late husband David Kindersley, gave her life to the discipline. She explains why it's so compelling.
There is something wonderful about stone because it has existed for 20 million years. And what we do is just knock little holes in it, or shapes. And what we take out of the stone is actually what we put back, because we knock away and we cut a letter, and that letter is nowhere to be found in nature. That's a cultural statement. So by taking that out of the stone, all of a sudden we're putting back into that stone our cultural position of this time.
Yeah.
We, of course, don't entirely know what that is. We just work with what we are, who we are, what we've got in our beings and what we see around us.
Now you make, obviously, you make headstones for graves, but you also make plaques and things like obelisks and sculptures and things like that. What is it, do you think, about those that capture something that people want to buy and want to have?
I think it's lastingness. You cut things in stone because you want them to last.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as I've already hammered down about five times, is that stone has been there. It's it's original in the making of the earth. You know, it's a solid rock on which we stand. And we pull it out and then we make it our own and we make it a cultural statement. There's something very powerful about the stones themselves.
It's the meaningful monolith, isn't it? It's all-beloving art. But basically, I mean, one of the things that interested me was that with that, you actually change people's perceptions of the significance of death away from necessarily being morbid and much more into a less negative thing of being something that captures things in the heart, in stone, in a way that can't be done with... it catches sentiments, doesn't it, in a way?
It does, indeed. And I think that the stone, again, makes something last that, of course, your life, my life, is not going to last. And when I love you very much and you die, I would like to hold some of your essence, and I stick it in stone, or basically I take it away, and therefore it is in stone. And it makes not only the value of your life, but the whole spirit of your life lasts in that stone. And I think that is without equal.
Can you tell me about the provenance and backdrop of the workshop? Because obviously your late husband David Kindersley worked closely with as an apprentice to Eric Gill, didn't he?
Yes.
How did that shape what he did with his life and later with you?
Well, totally, because he was working at the time. He wanted to be a sculptor, and he was working with masons, monumental masons, being the Induni brothers in London, and he was translating plaster casts mm-hmm. of RAs yeah. into marble. Mm-hmm. And according to Eric Gill, this was the ultimate dishonesty. Mm. You know, if you can't work in stone cutting things away, and once it's cut off, it's not put backable, if that's a word. Yeah. You know, of course, if you do something in plaster or whatever, you can stick it in clay, you can stick, you know, and I got your nose too big, I take a bit off. Oh dear, it's too small, I put a bit back on. In stone, it's absolutely what you've done, you've done. There is no coming and changing it. I think David was very much in awe of, having read Gill's book, in awe of that directness, that honesty. Mm-hmm. And when he went to see Gill, he was totally thrown by that honesty and openness and straightforwardness that we stonecutters have to have. It's not a nicety, because it's just part of life. And so he went to Gill, cut a long story short, in the end he was taken on. And it completely changed his life. It made him from, you know, having strong beliefs of being a sculptor into an actual maker, somebody who could, you know, David was incredibly talented and was already making wonderful busts and things at the age of 16. When he joined Gill, he got that discipline, the real stonecutter's discipline. And it is, stone demands discipline in the way you approach it. Every stage has a tool. And that neatness of working, David really got. But it didn't sort of dampen his soul. He was very wild in his...
There's something very important about doing something unique and different with your life to the mainstream, isn't there?
I think, to be honest, this sounds terribly horrible, but I don't understand how you could live without that power, without that need, without that directness, and leaving something behind that we think it's worthwhile. And of course, most of our work is on commission. So it's not because I think your life is worthwhile. Lots of other people think so.
Lettercutter Fiona Boyd is working on an elaborate headstone design and explains what goes into the work.
Now, you're working with a stone on a large wooden easel here, and you're cutting an inscription onto it. Can you tell me a little bit about exactly what that involves and what you're doing here?
This particular one is commissioned by somebody who commissions something every year for about 35 years. He's chosen a piece every year that he sort of comes up with a quote and then works with Leda to design something. So this one's a bit sort of arts and craftsy with quite tall lettering, which is not really in keeping with what we have around the workshop at the moment mostly. And it's got this kind of decorative ampersand with a sort of fire bush in all the decorations along the serifs and things.
So you basically, you lightly engrave the patterns onto it and then carve them in by hand. And is that really a difficult and painstaking process? It looks as though it is.
It's not painstaking, because I think we all enjoy it. So it's kind of, it can be frustrating if you don't make something quite as nice or as sort of slim or the right shape as you want it to be in your head.
Yeah.
Because we're all learning, so... sometimes what you have in your head is not quite connected to
it. Is there such a thing as perfection when doing this? Very nice.
In a way, there's more life to something because it's done by hand. It isn't quite perfect, although we sort of always aim for perfection. I almost think if you did reach it, you'd sort of stop, because you'd only go downhill from there. So we're always aiming for something better, I think.
So how long would something like this, which is, it probably has about 30 letters and then a rather interesting engraved floral design on it, how long would it take you to complete a piece like that?
I have to work that out myself, actually. I think we probably, on something like this, because I'm not in this letter form yet so much, I might do four a day, so sort of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, maybe that would be sort of a week and a half, and then this could be another week, probably, because it's so intricate, that's a sort of more playful thing that takes a bit more thinking.
And it must be a fantastic sense of accomplishment when it's all finished.
Yeah, it's really lovely to, we paint it and things, and then we're going, usually the person who's cut something will go and put it in place, because we fix things in place. So.
It takes both dedication and patience to reach the exacting standards, but it also requires a lifestyle which is off at a tangent from any other kind of job. Russell Purdom introduces the studio environment.
The Cardozer Kinsley workshop is primarily a letter cutting workshop, so we're cutting letters into stone using a hammer and chisel and our hands, without not using any machinery.
Now these are all kinds of things, aren't they? They're gravestones, and the sculptures, they're plaques, but they have a calligraphy which is special to this particular workshop, don't they?
Yeah, we have our own what we call the Kindersley capital, and we have an italic, which is ours as well. We design letters for the particular stone and for the particular design that we're working on. There are no standard letters, there are no templates or stencils
involved. Now, who are your customers that require this highly specialised type of stone carving skill?
All sorts of people, really. I mean, we deal with about a quarter of our work to a third of it is memorials. So that's headstones and plaques for cremations. And the other part of it is the university and people in the surrounding areas and internationally, really. We fix stones in America and sent to Japan and made sundials in Europe. So it's very varied.
Now, it's quite a difficult skill to actually learn, and you yourself have been here for quite some time. What does that in fact involve when to become someone who can perform this task, as it were, carving stone and plaques of one sort or another?
Well, we have a 3-year apprenticeship where we train for a minimum of 3 years, and that's really the minimum that you can train for, because you need an apprenticeship, ideally is 7 years, but we feel we can't really ask for 7 years of someone's time anymore in this day and age, which is a shame if you want to do this.
And if you make a mistake, I mean, see that one of your carvers at the moment is working on a beautiful gravestone, which he's carved dates and names and things on it. Mm-hmm. What happens if you make a mistake when you're doing that? Is it a costume mistake?
We work very slowly and carefully, so we just don't make mistakes like that. You can't afford to make a mistake, because if it happens, you have to start again, basically, we can't afford to do that.
And many people would have seen one of these at some point or another around Cambridge, on the outside of buildings, on gravestones, on plaques, possibly in museums as well.
Mm. If you look at the archive, it goes back to 1930.
Yeah.
One half of the archive goes from 1930 to about 1990.
Yeah.
And then the other half is the previous 20 years. So you get a feel for how much more demand there is. You know, it's an increasing demand as opposed to diminishing.
I mean, I see there are lots of other things other than stone plaques here. There are lots of art objects. There's beautiful sculptures. There are busts. There's also a wonderful sculpture of a swimmer's head, which comes out of the floor with a couple of hands in front of it, which looks as though it's swimming across the floor. Can you tell me a little bit about all those objects that are in the studio?
I mean, the workshop is full of things from its entire life, its entire period. There's a sundial we just happen to be standing under, which says Bellows Cottage on it, and there's two dates at the top, and it is here because the building that it was being made for burnt down as it was being made, so it never got there because the building doesn't exist.
You've got some beautifully carved bricks here which have faces on them that look rather like an Escher cartoon, as it were, on the side of each one. Have those been ordered for gateposts or part of a building?
No,
or
we were doing those purely to learn to carve, because we're letter cutters specifically, so we train to cut letters and not necessarily to carve figures, but we happen to be doing a very intricate memorial up in Yorkshire about 3 years ago. So we each had a head to carve, and we were learning from a man who used to be the head carver at York Minster, and he works in the old-fashioned medieval way of direct carving. So you start carving without a model. You have an idea of what you're doing, but you don't make a maquette. The kind of 19th century art school way is making an artist would make a maquette from clay, and then it would be then pointed using a pointing machine, which is the thing that enlarges or reduces that maquette, and it would then be carved by masons or sculptors.
Cardozo Kindersley is a fascinating place to discover because there's so much to see and learn about. There's a plethora of art objects and visual jokes and sculptures, and if you want to see them, you can arrange by phoning them. The whole business is virtually computer-free, and this is no mistake as the emphasis is entirely on handcrafted excellence from beginning to end, Secretary Janet Wheeler explains.
We've come into the archive now, and we're looking at a beautiful, beautifully, precisely kept archive of design drawings. Can you tell me a little bit about what's contained here?
Well, here we have the original drawings. every commission has a drawing. We don't do a full-scale drawing, and then things are drawn out by hand onto the stone or whatever material is being used. The archive goes right back to the 1930s, when David started letter cutting, and goes right up to the present day.
Now David was an apprentice to Eric Gill.
Yes, he was a sculptor, a typographer, a letter cutter, a very complex man. Mm-hmm. And David was, as you rightly say, apprentice to him.
And basically, when someone comes here, I mean, one of the things that you mentioned to me earlier was that, in fact, absolutely nothing in this company revolves around the computer age. There are no computers here, as it were, stencils made or anything. Everything is done by hand. It's archived by hand.
Yes,
and it's done by hand.
It is. Yeah. We do have a computer for the archive. Yeah. I mean, that is a necessity, really, because we want to preserve the archive in the best way possible.
Yeah.
But when it comes to cutting and designing, then no computers are involved.
Now these drawings, for each project you make a very small but very precise drawing that will show exactly what it's like.
That's right.
And that goes to the customer, and then after that it's in your hands entirely.
It is. The design comes back to us. If the client is happy, then we go on from there. Sometimes Leader makes alterations to the drawings, but yes, they have a small drawing and that's how it's done.
You found us, serving Cambridge and the surrounding areas. This is Cambridge 105.
It all started with a few hundred lumps of wet mud, but now it really is entirely a different matter and quite dazzling. And if you visit All Saints Church in Jesus Lane, you'll be quite impressed at what you find. I'm talking, of course, about the Christmas exhibition of the Anglian Potters, which has just opened and runs for the next month. The spacious, beautiful and slightly gloomy church is now gloriously lit up with bright exhibition stands and spotlights to show off a collection of 70 artists' work that shows just what's possible with ceramic sculptures, animals, garden pots and teapots, and a wide range of decorative work with a bit of flair and imagination. Anglian Potters treasurer Liz Chipchase introduces the work, which obeys no rules and lifts the inner spirit. Here we are, we're at All Saints Church in Jesus Lane, and anybody who knows this church knows that it spends a lot of the time reasonably empty, and it's been absolutely transformed. Can you tell us what's going on here?
Well, Anglian Potters are having one of their annual exhibitions here, so we've got something like 70 potters showing their work in the church. We've set up stands, and there are all sorts of different pots on display, partly for people to just look at and enjoy, and also if you want to buy a Christmas present, they're an excellent present.
It's quite a surprise when you come through the door, because it's wonderfully full of spotlights, white show stands, incredible pottery everywhere, people enjoying it, and it's going on for quite some time, isn't it?
It's going on for a month from today. We spent 3 days setting it all up, so all the stands have been assembled and all the pots brought in. And they're just here for people to enjoy.
Now there's not only, I mean, obviously there's lots of professional potters' work on display here. Can you tell me a few of the names that are here?
Yes, we've got Helen Humphreys, who makes green men pots and some lovely plates. We have got Kathy Darcy, who at the moment she's doing lovely little figures of kings and queens. We have... trying to think who else. Anya Penja has got some of her work here. We've got, there's probably about 16 of our selected members who are mostly professional potters.
Professionals. And then there's lots of material also from evening classes as well.
There are some potters work at evening classes, but most people now have got their own studios at home. I mean, they may work in the garden shed, but there are a few who only work at evening classes, but most people do it on a semi-professional basis.
Now this is a creative art and a skill that dates back to ancient times. What is it that makes people want to be a potter and make these things? What do you think triggers it off, this desire?
Well, there's probably as many reasons as there are potters, but there is something fundamentally really exciting about taking mud, effectively clay, and transforming it from something soft and malleable into something that is long-lasting and can be beautifully decorated. Something that you've made with your own hands is really appealing. And It's wonderful looking back at ancient pottery and seeing the fingerprints of the people who made it. And the feeling that you may be leaving something like that behind is very exciting.
Now it's obviously it's an ancient art. It's always been with us. And are there any new techniques or developments that are particularly to do with pottery in this modern time that haven't been used before?
I think possibly it is more common now for people to try and put some sort of political or environmental message across, like the Grayson Perry pieces, which often have images, modern images, that can be quite disturbing. Mm-hmm. I think that's probably new, but all the techniques that are used, the shapes that are used, even when you think you've come up with something new, you find that, oh, the Romans were doing it years ago.
Now, there's lots of different types of pottery, aren't there? There's earthenware, there's raku that you do, comes from Japan, doesn't it, originally?
Originally, there was a family called Raku, who produced a particular way of firing, but that was lost in Japan, and in fact has been highly developed by the Americans, mostly, in recent times. But there's stoneware firing as well as the earthenware, which is much more highly fired and makes more durable pottery. And then we have the decorative sort of pottery as opposed to functional pottery.
Now we've got some work just over here from someone called Michael Wickwall. Now that is absolutely fantastically imaginative piece of pottery, because it's a very large Mad Hatter's teapot, but it also has bulging eyes and things like that. I mean, you can do absolutely anything with these works, can't you?
You can. Yeah. You can make the most extraordinary pieces. Michael has got several pieces here which are completely non-functional but very, very striking. You would need to have the right sort of setting for them, but they are they're funny, they're amusing, and sometimes they're a little bit sinister.
Now obviously we've got grotesque things, but we also have here further work by Jane Hollidge, which is very, very modern, very chic and very different. That's really striking work, isn't it?
And it's beautifully coloured. The colours are very dramatic, and I think they really stand out because of the patterning on the surface, on the surface textures.
And also, obviously, there are lots of other things here. I mean, there's lots of sort of very classical-looking pieces, but there's also things like octopuses, mushrooms, and then there are pieces of pottery which are totally irregular shapes with jagged edges and blue insides, and they have, like, mottled stonework on the outside.
You can do so much with ceramics. I'm glad you noticed the octopus, because that's one of my favourites. Well, I made it. and I just love animals, so my pieces do tend to include animals. But when you are doing pottery, it becomes a challenge to try and push the clay as far as you possibly can. So you may tear it to give rough edges, or you may have potters who like to make it very smooth and very, very disciplined. So it depends on the potter entirely what you get.
For an octopus like that, how long would a project like that take to complete?
A day to make the plinth, a day to make the octopus and the other decorations on it, and then there are two firings with a glaze in the middle of those two. So probably it's about a week-long process.
Right, now the standard, obviously, at this exhibition is extremely high all the way through, and it's extremely eye-catching in every way. What are the community of potters like in Cambridge? Because there are an awful lot of them, aren't there? And they do this. I mean, how does it come together as a network, as it were, to produce an event like this?
Well, Anglian Potters covers the whole of East Anglia, and anyone, effectively, who's interested can join us. Yes. So some non-potters join us as well, but most people actually are hands-on potters. The Cambridge network is quite large. We meet regularly for demonstrations and things like that. But a lot of us met at evening classes.
Yeah.
Some of the people here are the people who taught us at evening classes. And we have our own website, so there are lots of ways in which we interact.
So if anybody wants to get involved in this, to come here, first of all, have a look at what you can achieve, but also if they get in touch with your organisation, they can find out where they can go and do this and meet the right people.
Oh, yes, indeed. Yeah, yeah. If you come along to the exhibition, we do have leaflets telling you how to get in touch with us and with other members of the community.
And obviously there's a Christmas aspect to this as well, which is that not only are you selling lovely trinkets and pieces of jewellery and bracelets and things like that, but you're also collecting for charity, I understand.
Yes, every Christmas we have a Christmas tree, which are decorated by all the potters contribute their own types of decoration, and we sell those for charity. This year it's the SOS Children's Villages charity.
If you fancy a breezy weekend walk down on Riverside, you might combine it with a touch of art focus and try visiting any of a dozen artists taking part in Winter Open Studios next weekend. A cluster of studios, all just a stone's throw from Elizabeth Way Bridge along Riverside and around Defrivel Avenue, feature painters, sculptors, jewellers, photographers and potters, and other artists using ceramics, drawings and textiles. Winter Open Studios presents exciting new work by esteemed local talent. Kathy Parker, Katie Bailey, Hannah Collins, Anne Culver, Lottie Atwood, Susan Cupid, Diana Kazemi, Mark Palmer, Helen Martino, Richard Heaps, Dan Manning and Bettina Stark. It gives people a rare chance to meet artists and see their work and talk about their inspiration. It runs next Saturday and Sunday from 10 till 5. Painter Kathy Parker introduces the event.
Most of us who are participating in these winter shows are members of the Cambridge Open Studios, which take place in July, as I expect a lot of your listeners know. And we've found that, people like our work and want to see it more than once a year. So 4 years ago, a group of us locally got together and decided to open our studios for one weekend at the end of the year as well.
Wonderful. Now, you have some new paintings here ready for this open studios. Can you tell me a little bit about those?
Yes. Well, my paintings really fall into two strands of work. One half of my work is a sort of naturalistic depiction of trees and landscapes. I go out into the countryside and I work en plein air, as the Impressionists used to say. And my work is very much a response to the light, the weather, the colours of the landscape. It's not photographically realistic, it's more an energetic, expressive sort of depiction of the landscape. I particularly like going to landscapes that I love. Yeah. I love going to local places like Wicken Fen, I love going to the Norfolk coast and the Suffolk Brecklands, where there are Scots pines and silver birches. And I can then enjoy painting and looking at the landscape and watching the birds as well. But the second strand of my work is done in the studio, and that is a more semi-abstracted landscape where I'm simplifying and trying to get to the essence of the subject. And the results can look simple, but it's actually quite difficult to simplify and abstract. And then I'm reducing things to colour and composition.
Yeah, they seem to be, I mean, I don't know how I can say the words to say this, but they seem to be something that is like a kind of distilled image, in so much as that they're very clearly drive that really.
Well, that's a very good word. Distilled is a very good way of saying that we're simplifying and abstracting and getting to the essence of the landscape.
As with the other artists, you have a lovely studio to show off and have a look at as well. Do you do all of your work in there? Because you've got obviously lovely easels and all your paints and everything set up there. Or do you have other places where you do it too?
Well, I should say it's half and half out in the field and in the studio.
Yeah.
But one of the things we feel as a group is that our studios are often domestic settings or working settings, and it's a very congenial way to come and see people's art and craft work. And so a lot of us clustered around this area of Defrevel Avenue. You can come and park, or you can walk and cycle between the different studios and see things in a very attractive domestic setting, which is maybe where you're thinking of putting the work yourself. And one of the things that we enjoy as artists is talking to people who come and see our work, finding out what they think. Sometimes people who come are other artists who want to get ideas. That's fine, that's fine. You don't have to come here with a view necessarily to buying. We're very happy for people to come and look and enjoy.
How much work do you normally do in an average year in terms of output of paintings, or do you just have bursts of work and then
bursts of work is definitely it. I go through phases where I'm very productive. I go out a lot, I get on a roll with a theme that I'm working on, and then maybe I go into a phase where I'm doing more framing, and there's always admin and email, you know, all that stuff that we all have to cope with, and that takes up time as well.
How often do you do something that you feel really brings you delight every time you see it, and you think, yeah, I really created something absolutely fantastic that time round, you know?
Well, at the moment, I'm in a really good phase. I should say that it's quite often. This year, I seem to be going from strength to strength and doing work that other people enjoy, and I certainly enjoy myself.
Yeah, I mean, you've got some really wonderful images here. This one here, this red one, is what is that? It's an abstract image, really.
It's an abstract. Yeah. It's a winter pool. Mm. So that the subject of that painting is tree trunks in the winter around a pool that's reflecting some of the winter light. But it's not a sort of blue and yellow summery scene. It's a more dark and moody scene.
Mm-hmm. And then you have, I see that you have a beach there. Whereabouts would that be taken?
That's the Coast Guard cottages at
Dunwich,
looking north up to Southwold.
Yeah.
And I've got another painting in the other room looking towards Southwold from the other side, from Cove Hythe, where there are sandy cliffs.
Mm-hmm. I mean, you seem to have achieved a great deal of painting with a very small amount of paint there, basically. There's a lot in the image, but then again, it's created with not very much material, if you said.
Well, that's a great compliment. The less is more thing.
Yeah, the less
and
is
the
more.
And the simplification. And then it leaves something for the viewer's imagination to create. If it's too photographically detailed, there isn't anything for the viewer to work at.
Wonderful.
I'm basically self-taught. I've always painted. I did art at school. I did art A-level, but I went to university to do academic subjects. So I've always had another job which has earned my living, but I've always tried to work part-time to have time for painting as well. And a couple of years ago, I gave up the day job so that I'm now a full-time painter, which is very exciting for me to have more time to do it. If you want to have more information about my work, or if you would like to email me and I can send you a PDF version of the Winter Shows maps, do have a look at my website, which is www.cathyparker.co.uk. That's Cathy with a C, Cathy Parker, all one word. And you can email me from there, or you can email me direct on cathy@cathyparker.co.uk.
When it comes to comedy scratch nights, it's often difficult to break away from tried and tested formulas and try something entirely new on audiences. It's notoriously risky, they just might not get it, and then again suddenly you find you've hit on something. Well, that's been the theme this week at The Junction, as another session of Jam Night attempts to break the mould, nurture new talent, and give new ideas a real chance and get audiences to feed back on them. Theatre groups Wet Picnic, Made in China and Get in the Back of the Van presented a scratch night which featured people jumping in and out of pianos, breaking crockery on stage and coping with oversized marrows with some dark and shocking humour. Kate Madden, creative producer, leads The Junction's core talent development programme.
Tonight is our jam night, which we have three or four times a year. It's a scratch night, and by scratch we mean an opportunity for artists to come together and show work that's at a very early stage, so maybe sort of between 5 and 15 minutes of an idea. And they present that to an audience across the evening. We've got cabaret tables, we've got suites, people drink throughout the evening, so it's really lovely and informal. And there's an opportunity for artists and audiences to talk and to feedback as the event progresses as well.
Now tell me about Wet Picnic.
They're a really exciting young company. They got in touch. They're associates at The Point in Eastleigh, which is a fantastic venue. And Wet Picnic often make work that is site responsive. This is one of the first pieces they're making for actually indoor venues. And I thought it'd be great to introduce them to our audience. They're in at the moment, actually. They're in the theatre space, so they're having their get-in and their tech. And it looks fascinating. They've got giant squares that contain different flowers and turf. It's called Death and Gardening, and already it looks like it's going to be a really inventive and visual. It does often involve a level of audience engagement. I think what they said for this scratch in particular is they've actually already made about 25 minutes of material, and for jam that are honing in on a particular sort of 8 minutes, which is one person's story, which will be performed to the audience, but they want to talk to the audience afterwards and to know what the audience thinks and to get their feedback.
What is the plot? What's the performance about?
Well, it's based around an allotment, and it looks at people's stories and lives and what it means to maybe live in an allotment or for an allotment to be your focus. And it's got lots of storytelling. They're quite a large ensemble as well. And I think it's quite early stages, and I think it's something the company will be able to talk to you more about as well in terms of where they're up to. But what I know is that it's storytelling, and it's looking at kind of love and life and the things that you share maybe in those sort of public spaces like allotments.
And what's this theatre group's background? Where did they come from? Where did they emanate from? What brought them together?
they are emerging. So I think they've only been together for a few years, and they all come from different backgrounds, but they are now one collective, and they've already done various different things across the country, and I think it's an opportunity for them to sort of make their junction daily, really.
Yeah. Now, as a creative director at the junction, obviously it's the city council venue, you're trying to provide something for everyone. What's your kind of ethos for booking in these acts? What do you look for in order to get a balance of performances for people?
Really good question. I think we look for work that we think's exciting. You know, we want to be discovering new artists, and we want to be at the forefront of the future of theatre. So often we're looking to discover new talent. We try and see as much as we can before we put it on, so we know that it's of a high level of quality. And also, from my perspective, I'm looking for work that I think is going to be enjoyable. I want people to come here and see something that's inventive, but also have a really, really good time. So it's that balancing act between really high quality, but also what do people actually want to come and see. And therefore, we're trying to present a real range of work. So there's dance pieces, there's theatre pieces and storytelling. There's also very experimental live art and work, and children's theatre that's really popular with parents in Cambridge as well.
Now you go to see them, what kind of things have you been to have a preview look at? What scores points in that?
Good question. I saw lots of the Edinburgh Festival actually, which was great, and lots of that work will be coming to the Junction in our spring season. So I saw a show by Blind Summit, who make wonderful puppetry, which is coming here next spring. I saw a brilliant show called The Oh Fuck Moment, which was something that was developed at the Junction by Hannah Jane Walker and Chris Thorpe. Chris Thorpe also collaborates with Unlimited and Third Angel, and that's going to come here as part of our Sanford Festival, and that's wonderful because you sit around a large table and it celebrates the sort of the kind of fuck-ups that you make in life, the small and the large, and you get to drink a cup of tea, and there's an element of interaction in that piece. It's set in an office space, so it's going to come to the Junction office in May. Also saw lots of pieces by Bryony Kimmings, who's one of our associate artists, and sort of been really, really proud about her journey and what she's been doing with us. And she's going to start something new with us in the spring, which is going to be called Art Crush, which is going to be an opportunity for Bryony and I actually to present the work that we think is brilliant in one night, a series of sections of work, and again people will have the opportunity to feedback as that night progresses as well.
Do you encourage people who have theatre groups or good ideas to get directly in touch with you here at the Junction?
Yeah, we do, and there's various ways that you can email me, which is my details are on the website. Check our website for opportunities that might be coming up regularly. We've got several artists performing tonight, and that's exactly right. Jam is a platform. It's a platform for us to see pieces of work, and the idea is that it's quite cyclical, so something at Jam actually comes back at a later date in our whole programme, and then audiences can see how a piece of work has grown. So we've got a company called Made in China who are coming back. Made in China are wonderful. They're doing lots of work with Battersea Arts Centre at the moment. They also scratched at Jam previously, and they've been part of the Sanford Festival. They make work which is highly visual, really, really daring and bold, and sort of looks at people and scenarios, and they're doing a scratch for us tonight that promises nosebleeds, broken crockery and Leonardo DiCaprio. So I think that's going to be a visual feast for everybody, and then we're hoping to continue working with that company. We've got Get in the Back of the Van coming, who have just done work at Soho. It's their Junction debut. They've got a piece called Eat and Mess, play on words, and looks at public schools and politics and what a mess everything might be, and again that's going to have whipped cream, so again it's going to be a real sort of a visual one. We've got the Plasticine Men coming back, who are an award-winning ensemble that makes storytelling and physical theatre. They've got a new piece called The Ostrich, which we're supporting, and we're going to get to see that one as well.
Well, Wet Picnic's Death and Gardening specialises in onstage mischief and dark humour that plays on relationships not being entirely what they seem when you dig deep. The group provokes laughs, cries, whispers and shouts in a series of wicked and probing explorations and gets the audiences involved. They formed at Winchester University and later perfected their act during a period in Paris and Russia and are typically promising. Actors Graham Coburn, Kelly Rayner, Ronan Defer and Victor Lukowski are supported by artistic directors and producers and performance coaches James Baldwin, Matt Freelich, Charlotte Jubri and Penny Patrick and Judy Barrington. Here they are, just before going on stage.
I would say that there's a huge reaction. I mean, just recently the company went to perform in Russia, and they had a bit of a fan base already. You know, there's people with signs with Wet Picnic, and it seems it's the word is spreading, and the company is becoming very, very important internationally, with you know, tours that are probably going to continue in that scope of not just England and the UK, but beyond. You know.
Now this is one project. Do you have how long will this run for, and do you have other things up your sleeve that are coming up in the near future?
We've got basically a 5-year artistic arc that's, you know, planned out, but we run projects simultaneously. So as the nature of the business is, while you're touring one piece, you're creating the next piece and you're running other projects alongside that, so you have a continually touring pattern.
Now, there are lots of young people in this region who want to get involved in acting and theatre groups and get commissions to do things like this. What would you say to them, having got yourself established and booked in?
You just got to be really passionate about what you do, really believe in it, and that will bring people to trust and believe in what you're doing, and you just got to work, sadly, very hard.
Tell me a little bit about the onstage antics. What kind of things are people going to discover here?
We're very naughty.
Yeah, very naughty.
Yeah, we have a lot of fun together on stage, and it radiates to the audience. I think we communicate our enjoyment, and they receive it, and it bounces back. So we like to involve them as much as possible. So Cambridge, beware.
A new director has taken over the helm of Cambridge University's Kettle's Yard Gallery as Michael Harrison retires after 19 years in the post. Andrew Nairn returns to Kettle's Yard after initially starting his career at the gallery in 1985. His career spans contemporary art galleries, arts administration and curating, and he's held directorships with the Icon Gallery in Birmingham, the Centre of Contemporary Arts in Glasgow and the Scottish Arts Council. He's also been Executive Director of the Arts Council of England. Nairn has worked with over 30 artists at the forefront of contemporary visual art. On taking up the post, he promised to enhance the programme of pioneering new exhibitions and to realise future plans for the new extension educational wing to promote great art for everyone and especially for children. He takes over from Michael Harrison, who's credited with leading a programme of events doubling visitor numbers, and his imaginative innovations with the house, which kept long-running questions and dilemmas about art alive. He's managed a highly successful programme of developments, which Andrew Nairn will now build upon. If you haven't spotted it yet, it's well worth noting that Vermeer's Women, Secrets and Silence is currently running at the Fitzwilliam Museum until January. The classic Dutch Golden Age painter captures women in a series of exquisite domestic scenes as they make up, read, write letters or make fine music. The masterpiece The Lacemaker is on loan from the first time in the UK from the Louvre in Paris, and there are other Vermeer masterpieces including the music lesson on display. There's an evening opening on November the 24th at the Fitzwilliam and a film on Vermeer at the Arts Picture House on December the 5th for anyone captivated by the work. And that's all from Arts Roundup this week. I hope you enjoyed the hour.